Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
All right, good afternoon, and welcome to another exciting episode of Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest on this Election Day 2012, along with my co-host, coolest of all, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mike.
Well, good evening, Annie. I have to admit right off the bat, I am very nervous today on this Election Day, so If I happen to be a horrible co-host, I'm apologizing for you in advance. And welcome everybody in the chat room. It's always, you know, it's really nice. Last couple shows, you walk into a chat room that's, it's almost like a line at the door. You know, it's a great feeling. Of course, a great credit to you, Annie. And Southern Sense would like to tell everyone we are reaching out to you, whether it's Facebook or Twitter. We have also a new website where you can buy all kinds of cool stuff. Annie has been working diligently, and we will be posting these links. We want to be your friend. And this way, if you're in your car, you just have your phone, and it happens to be Tuesday at 2 p.m., guess what? You can hear Annie and Cool Mike and all of our great shows on spot.
Yes, and I'm posting the link to our website. They can get it at southernsense.webs.com or southern-sense.com. Either way, it'll take you into our website. So if you forget or you can't get into Blog Talk Radio, just go to Southern Sense, and you can click on our show directly from the link on the webpage. And you go in there, and there's a fan chat room and everything. You know, sign up. Join up for the page. And we do have a little store where you can pick up coffee mugs or T-shirts or even a little sweater for your doggy. So got a lot of good stuff up there.
And remember, all proceeds go to help the Cool Mike Lap Dance Fund at the Adult Entertainment Club. So we encourage you. Well, anyway, we have, as always, Election Day. We are the start of a awesome Blog Talk Radio Election Day coverage. Honesty and integrity whether you like it or not like it, we tell it like it is and the truth, whether it's favored towards our side or not. We don't color anything black. We are the start. And as we get further later on to the show, we will be passing along the next link to the following show. But it goes all the way up till tonight, where it's going to be Jermaine, ABC, and Sarge. I will be at Bing headquarters tonight, so I'll try to call in, but probably not. But the most important thing of all of our shows, as always, that Annie does better than anybody on BTR, today's show is a dedication to one of our fallen soldiers. And with that being said, would you like me to play the Army music, Miss Annie?
Yes, if you would, Cool Mike.
Okay. And I'm a little partisan to the Army as well, because not only was my mentor a lieutenant colonel in the Army, but my father served in World War II. So,
yes, and anyway, my father served in World War II and his father in World War I.
You know, it's when we approach troubled times, I think often about just how wonderful these heroes really were. These people, most of them didn't turn out to be rich millionaires in life. They just were great Americans. They worked very hard. They loved their wife. They loved their family. If you really stop to think about it, Annie, many of these wonderful people ended up taking care of their in-laws as they got older. They weren't the type to put them here or put them there. They basically got an extra room and they stayed at the house until the end. Talk about just great people. I mean, that is those veterans of the World War II era.
Yes, it's true. It's true.
All right.
All right, this is dedicated to Army Private First Class James F. McClamrock. He was killed by an Iraqi soldier in Iraq on September 7th, 2010. Mike, can you lower that just a little bit?
I will.
This is from the Independent Tribune in North Carolina. All of Concord, North Carolina, stopped briefly to honor a fallen soldier. Private First Class James McClamrock returned home from Iraq to cities that closed up shops, cleared an interstate, and stood silently on the sides of the road to pay tribute to him and his family. McClamrock was killed on September 7, 2010, when a man dressed in an Iraqi army uniform fired on American soldiers. He was one of two killed after major combat operations were cleared over on August 31st, 2010. Hundreds of people lined the streets as the mile-long procession drove from Charlotte Douglas International Airport to its final destination at Hartsfield Funeral Home on Branchview Drive. Charlotte-Mecklenburg authorities closed down northbound Interstate 85 from the airport to Dale Earnhardt Boulevard as the procession passed. On every overpass on I-85 in Mecklenburg and Carrabas counties, firefighters lined bridges, running their emergency lights and displaying large American flags to passersby. Residents slowly made their way onto several of the overpasses, paying their respects as a long line of Patriot Guard riders, emergency personnel, and others in the procession snaked north to Dale Earnhardt Boulevard. As the cavalcade reached surface streets, it was again met with an outpouring of community support. School children from Beverly Hills Elementary School lined Church Street. Alongside the children, many of the business people stopped working to step onto the sidewalk and salute the fallen soldiers. Others stood silent, waving flags or covering their hearts with their hands. In downtown Concord, storefronts closed about noon and people lined the sidewalk on Union Street as the procession rolled through. Business owners passed out all American flags to bystanders as they waited for the procession. The Lions Club left out flags from Labor Day on the sidewalk. At 12:45 p.m., the procession came around to Roberts County Courthouse on Bourbon Avenue and slowly made its way up to Concord City Office. The Patriot Guard riders, 100 strong, rode ahead of the hearse and the family van. The noise of their motorcycle engines reverberated off the building. Then the hearse stopped, and the van stopped in front of City Hall. A Concord Fire and Life Safety Honor Guard stood in the street, flanked by the City Council. Mayor Scott Padgett and Dr. Henry quietly spoke to the family, presenting them with a key to the city. Henry, a colonel in the Army Medical Corps, who served 6 months in Iraq last year, was dressed in his fatigues. All activity stopped in downtown Concord for 5 minutes as the mayor made the presentation. There wasn't a sound, save for the van engine and a distant news helicopter. Then the family boarded a van to the trip to the funeral. Battalion Captain Ed Shaver, commander of the Honor Guard, broke the silence, calling a group of police officers and firefighters to attend. They took as the first family drove on. The event affected Dr. Hickman, said, I told them how much Concord not went to the sacrifice. Choked up, Ed shows just how dangerous it breaks the heart. As coming ceremony at Wilson Air Center at the airport. The charter plane carrying the crime wrecked body was towed into the hangar, where Patriot Guard riders lined the inside of the American flag. Glamrock worked with the PSA at Charlotte Drug for Joseph Arnold. His work with the PSA inspired the Army. The hangar was full of PSA workers. Glamrock was a college. Up front, there were rows of cheers. Glamrock's family is meeting the plane to land. Military honor guard just decided to walk off the plane to the hearse. The fallen soldier's family looked on. Every motion made by the honor guard was methodical, deliberate, like they were moving in slow motion. Then the motorcade departed from Concord. The northbound line planes of I-85 were entered from the airport to Suffolk Cross Campus. Its authorities closed on ramp, firefighters lined both the past, silence to Glamrock family. The whole process is something I'll never forget, had to say. This is the second time that Robert County turned out on a whole focus. May festival, Christopher Bart, 20 killed in Afghanistan. Harrisburg, South Carolina. Glamrock, third soldier, dropped here. McClamrock's father, Mark, grew up in Concord. His father, James, grandfather, was Fleet McClamrock, who was a longtime Concord police officer. Mark is pastor of the Concord ARP Church on Union Street and officiated on his son's funeral. He became pastor of the church in 2008 and moved his family back to his hometown. McClamrock's siblings all live in Concord. Go to Coltrane Webb Element and Concord Middle Schools. Students from those schools were out on the edge of the street with procession to honor the classmates. Gladbach is survived by his parents, his wife, three brothers, and he died in Iraq, suffering on the roof. And to all of our fallen heroes, we dedicate this song, My Name is America, by Todd Allen Herendon. God bless you.
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Be ashamed if you hurt me, I'll get strong. others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up from the flames, and I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America, don't tread on me. America is my name. For those who need me, I'll always be here. For those who will harm me, I'll face without
Todd Allen Herndon, My Name is America. You can find that up on YouTube, but he also has a website up, so just Google Todd Allen and My Name is America, and you can download that song for free. That's a great song. I mean, I sent him a message, let him know that we play it after every dedication.
That is just, I absolutely love that song. You listen to it, and it's just, oh, my God.
Yeah, we got ourselves a really packed day here today. We start off the marathon here with the best of BTR. And then from 4 to 6, we have Billy and Brenda from Women's Patriots. And their show is on Conservative Nation Radio. Then we have The Voice, Stefan Vandegast. And Stefan, I couldn't locate...
I do that again. The Voice.
The Voice. Stefan will put up his link to his show. I could not find it for some reason. It just went the way of cyberspace. He's from 6 to 8. And then from 8 to 9, we have Dr. C. Robert Jones, who happens to be missing in action at this moment with his situation report from 8 to 9. And then from 9 to 11, we got Dana Smearman, who has linked up with G-Ski, who rocks, on the Conservative Watchtower. And then followed up by you, Mike, with Jermaine GGT 183 from 11 to 1. So this is going to be a packed, packed day. And I have a poll party to go to about 7 o'clock tonight. So if I call into any of the shows, it will be from that.
A poll party?
A pool. Yeah, a poll. Poll. Not a pool. Poll.
No, I know. But so, like, you're going to be, like, in a G-string and thong dancing and swinging?
No.
Well, you said it. I'm just, you know what kind of work, line of work I'm in. I was like, dang. I knew you and Yanni were a tight crowd, but man, I think there's a certain amount of tension in the air for a lot of sides. I think especially for our side, and when I say our side, I mean people who really believe in the Constitution, because I think clearly either a people's revolution is in serious motion or it is not.
Yeah, and I'm gonna, anyone out there listening in, that if they are going to the polling place today, keep your eyes and ears open. I went and voted early. And when you do absentee voting, you can only do it if you meet certain criteria, such as if you're disabled, if you're active military or military family, if you're going to be performing jury duty, if you're going to be out of the state or working as a poll worker in another county other than where you vote. You have to meet these criteria, and they're supposed to ask every person who goes in voting early, you know, what their reason is. And if it doesn't match the criteria, then you can't vote early. And when I went and voted early, they asked only about 1 in 5 people what their reason for voting early was. That's wrong. Second thing is, which someone caught and they finally removed it, there was a picture of Obama as soon as you walked into the polling place. They finally got them to take that down. I got an email from someone today saying that the polling place, the machines are all down, so they're handing out paper ballots. And the paper ballots can only be filled out if you've got a black or blue ink pen, not a pencil, pen. They were having people fill out these ballots with pencils. So I notified the authorities in that one. Now I'm seeing in Philadelphia, in Ward 35, there's this huge Obama mural on the wall where the polling place is. Well, a judge finally told them they've got to cover it up. Well, it's kind of partially covered so far. I'm sure they'll get the rest of it covered sooner or later. There's another polling location, I believe it's Ward 5 in Philadelphia, where a poll worker is telling people to vote Democratic. When he boots up the machine and sets it up for the person to vote, he shows them the Democratic straight line ticket, what button to push for that. Someone challenged him on it, and then the guy's attitude changed. You know, people, you've got to be out there, be aware if you go out and vote.
That is unbelievable. I mean, no, it is believable. I think in a lot of ways, as much as that kind of stuff is aggravating, I don't think it really influences anything. I think for the most part, virtually 100% of the people vote for who they set out to vote for when they're at the polls at this stage. Last night we were doing some last minute campaigning, just lit drops, a dropping of literature. And, you know, for the most part, I think people who do vote, planned on voting, I think they got in their car or they walked to the polls or however they got there, they knew exactly who they're voting for. I don't really think a mural or anything has that big an influence, but clearly it just, again, shows the contempt of just the voter laws and regulations that really stood for 200 years and never even got broken up until, say, probably the last 15 years.
Well, there's always going to be some sort of a voter fraud, you know. But just now, you can see it a little bit better because now we have the media, this type of media, talking about it. So now it's being reported by stations such as Fox. And I know a lot of people aren't fans of Fox, but at least they're reporting it. I'm going to wonder how much at the end of the day you're going to see CBS, CNN, NBC, MSNBC doing any of this reporting, if they do.
I'm surprised MSNBC didn't call it for Obama last night, Angie.
I think Bob Beckel on the 5 was trying to do that. It just wasn't quite working. Oh, man. Listen.
Like, holy cow.
Remember I told you that on Friday after I got off the show, I was doing that Rock the Vote speech over at the University of South Carolina?
Yes, you were.
Guess what? The room had maybe about 100, 150 people in there. And out of that, maybe 10 of us were Republicans. Only 10. The room was packed with people running for people. There's a woman called Bobby Rose running against Tim Scott for the House of Representatives here in South Carolina. And there was a whole group of people that were all for Obama. And, you know, it was interesting trying to give them a speech. The first few people, they got through quietly because they really didn't say who to vote for. They just said how they got involved in politics. So it wasn't anything to say, all right, you know, I'm a Republican, this is what I stand for. Well, the next person that got up was for Romney Camp. And he gets up there and he starts speaking and he starts getting heckled and catcalled and people challenging him as he's speaking. And the moderator, what happened was the moderator had walked away for about 2 seconds to give someone some medication. I guess he was holding it for this person. When he came back into the room and he saw what was happening, he stopped it, thankfully. And then he took control back again. But then he warned the rest of us that if you see that happening, don't allow it. You know, just do what you do and don't stop to answer the heckling. Well, of course, now I get up and I'm like second to last. And I'm the last Republican to speak. And I, of course, am going to give them my opinion. I'm not one, obviously, to keep my mouth shut. And I start going through it, and I get to the part where I mention Obama's failure on foreign policy in the Middle East. Someone shouts from the back of the room, but he got bin Laden. And I'm going through it, and I'm explaining what was in my speech. And I said, you know, at this point, I said, there's a YouTube video up by a girl named Jennifer. She's a 13-year-old girl. She did a report card for Obama and one for Romney. And she gave Obama an A on the war on terror for getting bin Laden. And I had used that line, and I turned around and I threw it directly at the guy. And I said, she gave him an A for the war on terror for getting bin Laden, sir. And then I followed it up with, said, I respect your intellect. Please respect mine. And at that point, everyone, you know, just backed down. But it was interesting.
So how far of a drive was it for you?
It's about a half an hour drive to go from where I am in Beaufort County to where where this campus for University of South Carolina is in Bluffton. It's about a half hour ride. But we have one that's about maybe 10 minutes away in downtown Beaufort that is the original University of South Carolina campus. But
oh, okay.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to a game there at the?
Oh no, those games are up in Columbia, and Columbia is 3 hours away.
Okay. You know, I was expecting when we signed off the show for Friday, and we were all excited about today, as we normally are. I mean, we love politics. I was expecting, honestly, like a little in that theater you were doing the speeches. I was expecting a brawl. I was expecting a picture to go viral, like, of the fighting, and I was going to picture you with, like, a chair swinging it, and I was going to be like, that's Annie.
No, everything is civil. Everything is civil. Hey, listen, we're going to give a little plug for Romney and Ryan. So
also,
here we go.
Before we plug Romney and Ryan, if you look in the chat room, present and accounted for is Dr. Jones, so nobody has to panic.
Man up. Someone woke the old man up. Welcome aboard, Doc Jones. And I see we got Iggy with us, too. All right. This is for Romney and Ryan.
Romney and Ryan 2012. Romney and Ryan 2012. They'll serve our country well. They'll bring back our economy. They'll bring back jobs for you and me.
America and love this land. With Romney and Ryan, you'll take a stand. Ribbly.com.
All right. Those are my two friends, the Ribbly Review. That song gets your feet tapping, doesn't it?
Yeah, I love that. I love that song. I think that whenever you have faster-paced songs, there's a lot of cute stuff in there, but in a lot of ways, too, it's also there's some accuracies, and let's hope that some of them are true, where you have Paul Ryan, working as a constitutionalist, vice president, and let's hope so. It's, man, the clock is moving awful slow on this election day for me. I can I can tell you that.
Absolutely. And we're waiting for our guest to call in. Our guest today is, I have a hard time pronouncing his first name, Dr. Brook from the Ayn Rand Institute. So hopefully we'll have him calling in shortly.
Well, part of the, a couple things real quick while we're waiting, and I know I think we were supposed to call Bing. I may have forgotten. But anyway, either way, we have some huge races that are taking place as far as for the Tea Party. And in Texas and in Indiana, in the U.S. Senate races, as well as in the Southern California races, we have some great veterans and true constitutionalists running. I mean, these are huge elections. There are many that we don't know about as of yet. But, I mean, this clearly brings tonight can clearly show a message on exactly what tonight means. Obviously, if it's a big win for Obama and none of our candidates win, it's probably, sadly, as close to the end of the road as we could get. But I mean, if they fail, this can be the match, Annie, that drops into the ignition. And I mean, just a. Hey, I think we have our caller. We have our caller on.
Hello.
And I'll tell you what, let's bring our caller on. Annie, are you with us, Annie? Because he's on, our caller's on the air.
Okay, gotcha.
All right. Well, after, on this election day 2012, I'll hand it back to Annie and we can introduce our awesome guest.
Yeah, good afternoon, Dr. Brook.
Good afternoon, how are you?
All right. Seems I caught you in your car or something.
I am, unfortunately. I'm going to try to stop here so that we have less noise.
Okay, great. Want to introduce to our audience, Doctor, I have a hard time pronouncing your first name.
Yaron.
Yaron, okay. Dr. Yaron Brook, I apologize for that, of the Ayn Rand Institute. Okay. As Dr. Brook parks his car, we'll go on and... he has a book out that's up there called The Free Market Revolution, which is a must-read for everyone. The book is actually an indispensable reading for anyone who wants to understand why some people impose the entitlement state. It's a fantastic book to read.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay. Now, Dr. Brook...
I was going to say, I love the cover of the book, too, where basically it's a blue background and it has a picture of the Statue of Liberty, who is somewhat of a Hercules type looking, and in the background are the twin towers, and it says, the Free Market Revolution. Very cool front cover. Who is Don Watkins?
Don is a fellow at the Institute. He is my co-author, and he did a lot of the writing and a lot of the work in this book. So it's very much a co-author project, and. The cover was, we were very happy when the publisher proposed this cover. I think it captures the spirit of the book, which is supposed to inspire us, really. We wrote it to inspire people to really fight for free markets, to try to really convey to the culture what free markets are and why they're right, why they're good, why they're moral, why it's not just that they work, but they're also just and fair. We shouldn't give those words to the left. And let them dominate fairness and justice.
Yeah, it actually does become a war of words, the way the progressives have a tendency to co-opt certain words and make them mean something completely different. Now, Doctor, your background was not one that would have lent you towards being a follower of Ayn Rand. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. I mean, I was born and raised in Israel in a period where Israel was very socialist and very collectivist. It's moved a little bit away from that in recent decades, but certainly when I was growing up, you didn't know anything but socialism. There was no alternative. Nobody imagined an alternative. I was very much committed to socialism and collectivism until I picked up a copy of Atlas Shrugged and read it, and I really fought the book. It really challenged everything I was brought up on, everything I believed in. And by the time I finished reading the book, I was convinced she was right. And, you know, everything I'd been told and everything in the culture around me was wrong. And that was quite a challenge. And that was at age 16. So I was pretty young, but I was already kind of thinking about these issues and already committed to ideas.
You and I are not far apart in age. Matter of fact, you're about the same age as my sister. And I remember at that time, a lot of the kids that were of Jewish backgrounds talking about going to Israel to work in the kibbutz. And I would say that was the biggest socialist project that you've had there in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, the kibbutz is really a communist project in a sense that it's complete equality. You don't actually, at least historically, the kibbutzim, you didn't specialize. You rotated jobs. You didn't raise your kids by yourself. The kids were all raised communally in a house that just had all the babies in it. So the babies didn't even stay with the mothers after they were born. You didn't cook. Nobody had a kitchen in their home because cooking was a communal activity and eating was a communal activity. You ate in a big dining hall. So it was very much an experiment in communism, and of course, like all communism, it was a complete failure. It failed economically. It failed socially. People in the kibbutz tended to hate each other's guts. They lived in each other's lives. They envied each other. They resented each other. People who were able, who had the ability, who worked hard, resented the fact that other people, were lazy and didn't do the work yet. Received exactly the same benefit, exactly the same outcome. And at the end of the day, the kibbutzim failed, and we're just seeing over the last 2 to 3 decades, of course, they were always sustained with government subsidies and government favors. But as Israel has moved away from socialism, the government stopped subsidizing them, and they were forced to privatize and to change the way they did business. And today, the kibbutz doesn't look anything like it did 20 years ago. Today, they're much more like villages and much less communal and much more, I hate to say capitalist, but in that direction at least, than they were in the past. Capitalism works and socialism doesn't. And it doesn't matter where you try it, and it doesn't matter which geography, it doesn't matter what time frame you try it. Socialism fails, collectivism fails, capitalism and individualism work. They actually produce the goods.
Yeah. Now, someone asked a question, which is one of the first questions I was going to bring up with you, is President Obama's recent statement about Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged. I can hear you getting ready for this one. He was quoted as saying, Ayn Rand is one of those things that a lot of us, when we were 17 or 18 and feeling understood, we wake up. Then as we get older, we realize that a world in which we are only thinking about ourselves and not thinking about anybody else, in which we're considering the entire project of developing ourselves as more important than our relationships to other people and making sure that everyone else has opportunity. That's a pretty narrow vision. It's not one that I think describes what's best in America. Unfortunately, it seems as if sometimes that vision of you're on your own society has consumed a big chunk of the Republican Party. Wow.
Yeah, well, first, I have to thank Rolling Stones for asking President Obama about Ayn Rand. I mean, it's a great plug for the book, the fact that he slams it. And, so I think it'll increase sales. So I'm happy about that. But, yeah, I mean, this is the typical argument from the left. The argument is, look, Ayn Rand is a thing people do when they're teenagers, and people grow out of it. Of course, it doesn't explain the fact that Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged sold in 2009 half a million copies. I can guarantee you most of those copies didn't sell to teenagers. Since Obama was elected, the book has sold almost 2 million copies. The more and more people are reading the book, more and more people engage with the ideas. These are profound ideas that go to the heart of what it means to be a human being, to the heart of what it means to be a member of society, and to the heart of what kind of society we want and what kind of economic political system we want. And yes, she is an individualist. She does believe, as the Founding Fathers believed, that the role of government is not to dictate our lives as individuals, but to leave us free to pursue our own values. Yes, she does believe in rational long-term self-interest, but that incorporates the people. I mean, my self-interest is to love other people. It's my self-interest. Some people hate other people. It's in my self-interest to trade with other people. It's in my self-interest to, go into the marketplace and have relationships with people, to have friends, to have loved ones. So this notion that being self-interested or thinking about yourself means being isolated, going out on a desert island, is bizarre and complete nonsense, and proves that people of old that don't think. Because if you thought about it for 1 minute, you would realize that your interest is in living in a society where other individuals are free to produce and to trade and to think and to create just like you, so that you can trade with them and you can benefit from their creativity and you can benefit from their thinking, you can benefit from their productiveness. And you want to have friendships and you want to have love, not because friendship and love are sacrificial, not because friendship and love are selfless, but the opposite, because friendship and love are self-interested. I love because I benefit from the people I love. I have friends because we benefit from each other. We're traders. They benefit from me. I benefit from them. Healthy human relationships are trading relationships. And I'm not talking about trade in terms of money. I'm talking about trade in terms of spiritual values.
That's fantastic. The funny thing is, I've noticed with this Frankenstorm, as they call it, Hurricane Sandy, all of my friends that I've contacted that were in that area that got through the storm with the least amount of problems were people like you and I that took care of our self-interest. They made sure they had water. They made sure they had a generator. They made sure they had alternative heat if that heat should go out, if the electricity should stay out. And every last one of them said, no, I made sure I took care of my family. And that's self-interest. But, it's not just greed. It's making sure that we don't have to waste government resources on taking care of us.
It's more than that. It's the fact that successful people who are successful at life, are people who take their life seriously and people who devote energy and thinking and resources to figuring out how to live life the best that they can live it for themselves. And what people like that really want is they want to get the government off their back. They want to get their neighbors off their back. They don't want their neighbors telling them how to live and what to do and how to do it. And they don't want the government telling them what to do and how to do it. They want to be able to get to have the pride and the self-esteem that comes with taking care of your own life, being productive. And if they see a neighbor who is a good person in trouble, they will be the most benevolent people, self-interested people, free people, are the most benevolent people. They always jump up to help worthy people. They're not going to help everybody, but they're going to help the people that are worthy of help. They take care of themselves, they do well, and then they take care of others, the others that are worthy of their help. But they don't force others to help. They don't believe in coercion. They don't believe, and that's government, right? Government is coercion. They don't believe it's the role of government to take care of people, because if they take care of you, they often get to tell you what to do. And as independent thinking people with pride and self-esteem, we don't want the government to tell us what to do and how to live our lives.
Yeah. Now, how would you have what you call rational selfishness apply to our foreign policy?
Well, we don't have a foreign policy.
Well, because I know Romney and Obama in the debate were going at it over China, and I don't think either one of them have it exactly right.
I don't think either one of them has a clue when it comes to foreign policy. I think they're both completely ignorant, and neither of them understand what is in American self-interest. So let's take China. Our self-interest is to trade with China. We benefit enormously from trade with China. Now, if China is a threat to the United States, if we believe that China is an enemy of ours, then we shouldn't be trading with them, and we should cut off our relationships and treat them as an enemy. But I don't think China is an enemy, and I don't think anybody should think that. You know, China's got problems. China's a dictatorship, but it's a dictatorship moving towards freedom. It's moving in the right direction. They're producing cheap goods that we get to buy cheaply, so we have more money for more valuable things that we can produce and make. So my view of foreign policy is we should advocate for free trade. We should advocate for lowering trade barriers and allowing Americans to trade with Chinese, with, you know, Europeans, with you know, Taiwanese, with whoever, to trade to our benefit, to mutual benefit. Trade is a win-win. Nobody loses when you trade. So I'm a very much an advocate for free trade. And then when it comes to the Middle East, I mean, Obama is terrible when it comes to the Middle East. I mean, he's apologetic. He believes that it's all America's fault. We should apologize to the world. I think Romney was absolutely right about Obama's apology tour. But Romney's not much better. Romney is just mildly better than Obama. I think, you know, we should, you know, identify the enemies, our true enemies in the Middle East, and I think we should destroy them. And I think we should leave the rest of the Middle East alone, let them rot. We should not get involved. We shouldn't be giving Egypt a dime. Egypt is being ruled by the Muslim Brotherhood. They shouldn't get a dime of American money. Generally, I'm not a big believer in foreign aid. We shouldn't take sides in Syria. The best thing in the world for us is for the two sides who are both enemies of the United States to fight it out between each other. What do we need to get in the middle of that? Look what happened in Libya when we got in the middle of a battle between two sides that were equally hateful of America. We need to identify who our true enemies there are and leave everybody else alone, and who our true friends are.
All right, so what would you say then with the leaked news, supposedly of Valerie Jarrett personally negotiating with Ahmadinejad?
Well, I think it's a disgrace. I think it's a disgrace. I think it's a betrayal of American principles. But you know, this isn't new. You know, Bush negotiated with Iran. Reagan negotiated with Iran, if you remember the bombs for hostages. I mean, everybody's negotiated with Iran. We have not had a rational foreign policy in the Middle East, I don't know, maybe since Teddy Roosevelt, maybe even since Thomas Jefferson, who, if you remember, sent the Marines in to kill all the pirates. We can't even get rid of the pirates off the coast of Somalia. We're still battling the same battles as we did in the 19th century. It's pathetic. You know, so I believe that it's in the United States' interest to destroy Iranian nuclear capacity, not to have sanctions, not to talk to them, not to wait, not to sit on our hands, to launch the whatever weapons we need to launch, you know, to destroy that capacity, you know, and make it clear to the Iranians that they do anything to harm us, they will regret it. And unfortunately, America's lost the ability to say that. We don't shock and awe anybody anymore. Nobody believes we're a real tiger. They all think we're a paper tiger. And they're all justified to think it because nobody on the Republican or Democratic side has what it takes to actually defend America and to take on, you know, the enemy. And I think Iran is definitely part of the enemy.
All right, so what's your morality then of war? And I noticed there's one thing I had looked up, believe it or not, I cross-referenced everything. I just pulled up your biography out of Wikipedia as if they're going to be favorable to you. And there was something in there that just blew my mind. They wrote about you. Brooke claims that the West isn't at war with terrorism, but the ideology of Islamic totalitarianism. He repeatedly says that just like World War II, America wasn't at war against the Japanese kamikaze pilots or the German tanks, but the ideas of Nazism and Japanese imperialism. You know, it's in a way that's true, but they go on to write that you claim the Islamic totalitarians are Muslims who wish to dictate every part of our life from the teachings of Islam taken to its logical extreme. And my biggest part with that is teachings of Islam is subjective because there's really no true, you know,
sure. No, so,
guidelines.
So my view is, but I think everything you read there is truly represents my view. My point is not that I want to say what the consistent application of Islam is. I don't know, because you're right, it's subjective. But what they want, what the Islamic totalitarians, the Bin Ladens, the Ahmadinejads, the Muslim Brotherhood, what they want is they want to apply Sharia law. They want to apply a radical vision of Islam to every aspect of our lives. They want a totalitarian world government run by Sharia law. They believe in that. It's bizarre to us. We think that's crazy, and it is crazy, but they actually believe in it. And if we don't take that seriously, we're in deep trouble, and that is the enemy. I think Bush made a huge mistake by calling for a war on terrorism. You cannot have a war on the tactic. You have to have a war against a country, against a country that symbolizes a particular idea. And in this case, I think the war should have been waged against Iran and Saudi Arabia, the two countries that advocate for Islamic totalitarianism, the two countries that funded, promoted, you know, and advocated for it throughout the Middle East and the whole world. And now it's too late. Now that ideology dominates most of the Middle East. But in 2002, we had a chance to change things, and we blew it. And we will suffer the consequence for decades to come.
Well, then how do we correct that mistake?
I don't think we can correct the mistake, because I don't think we have the moral fortitude to correct that mistake. I mean, my view is that we need to have the guts to name the enemy, Islamic totalitarianism. Even Bush didn't have the guts to do that. I think we need to then focus in on the countries that support it, and we need to have the guts to use military force to its fullest instead of going to Afghanistan and Iraq and building them sewers and building them schools and bringing them democracy and bringing them the good life. The only purpose, in my view, of the American military is to defend the lives and property of Americans. It's to protect our rights, and it's to do whatever's necessary in order to achieve that goal. And you ask me what I believe we should do in war. I think we need to win. I think that is the only standard. It's victory, and we need to do whatever's necessary to win the war. And we understood that when we fought World War II. World War II, we understood that we had to do whatever it took, use whatever weapons necessary to win. Now, I think this war is easy to win relative to World War II, because these guys have no weapons. They have no military. They're pathetic as compared to the Japanese or the Germans. So this should be easy for us. But we just don't have it anymore. We don't have the guts that they had in the 40s. And we really haven't had since World War II. America has not won a single war. We've lost all the wars we've fought, and we've gotten into wars we should have never gotten into, because we view ourselves as an altruistic, save the world military rather than a military that's out to defend the rights of Americans, and that's it.
All right. So in other words, when we had the attack in Benghazi, Obama should have gone in and just zapped the place and then just walk away, saying, hey, listen, this is our sovereign territory. You violated it, and now this is your penalty.
Yeah, but we shouldn't have been there, and we shouldn't have taken sides in the Gaddafi, uprising. We shouldn't have any involvement in Libya. Libya is in a civil war. They want to kill each other. It's none of our business. Stay out of there. If they attack American soil, if they attack something that's American, then you go in. But as long as they're just fighting among each other, why did we bomb Libya? What interest did we have there? What? Nothing. So once we get ourselves in those situations, we're asking for trouble. There's no good way out of it. What are we doing? Why are we still in Afghanistan? What are we doing doing in Iraq? What are we doing in all these places? What's the strategy? You know, Romney wants to intervene in Syria. What for? What interest does it serve the United States to intervene in Syria? So my view is, let's focus in on foreign policy on what America's interests truly are. Stay out of everything else. But when somebody attacks us, crush them. You know, destroy them. Make it clear to the world, if you mess with us, you will die to regret it.
Amen to that. Now, of course, you know, today being Election Day, there's been a debate going back and forth ever since I can remember voting about Electoral College versus the majority vote. And I support the Electoral College system. Why do you?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely support the Electoral College because it is – I support anything that removes us from direct democracy. I think direct democracy is very dangerous. It is the you know, as I think Madison said, it becomes the dictatorship of the majority. It becomes the majority, you know, dictating to the minority what should be done. So I'm all for separating us from direct democracy as much as we can, and the Electoral College does that to some extent. If you had direct democracy, the candidates would be spending all their time campaigning in New York City, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, in the big cities in Texas, and that would be it. They would concentrate on heavily, heavily populated regions because that's who would determine the election. I mean, one of the advantages of having an electoral college is that it requires the candidates to spread out across an entire state, which means that it's across an entire segment of the population, all the different segments, at least within a given state or at least within, in this case, 10 states. So you get a cross-section of the population. You don't get appeasing just one section. And I think our voices count more this way, and it's a better system than a pure majoritarian system. I generally don't like majoritarian systems in pretty much anything. The majority is usually wrong, and the majority almost always wants to take stuff from the minority. And, you know, the ultimate minority is the individual. You know, this country is about individualism. It's not about majorities. It's not about collectives. It's not about groups. It's about individuals being free to pursue their happiness.
Yeah, basically what you just did was the definition between a democracy and a republic then.
We are a constitutional republic. We are not a democracy. The fear is, and what's happened to the United States over the last 200 years, is we're becoming a democracy. And I think the United States today is more a democracy than a republic. I think it started out as being a constitutional republic, and we have systematically moved away from that, and we're becoming more and more of a democracy at the expense of freedom. What we're losing in the process is individual freedom.
Absolutely. And what would you do? What would you tell Romney when he becomes president about the Patriot Act? Would you tell him to rip the whole thing up or just gut parts of it?
I think at this point I would rip the whole thing up, and I would do, Romney would never do this, but what I would do is I would say, look, we need to reconsider who the enemy is. We need to reconsider, you know, what our strategy needs to be. And I would go to Congress, and I would demand that Congress make a declaration of war against the enemy, if we have one. And at that point, I would say, okay, as long as the declaration of war is in place, there are certain security measures that we have to enforce. Some of them may be in the Patriot Act today. But I think what Bush did, which was a crime, was that he didn't declare war. There was no congressional declaration of war, but we got the Patriot Act, and therefore the Patriot Act will never go away. What we need is a clear declaration of war. We need a standard by which we define victory, and then an understanding that whatever measures we put in place, as soon as the war ends, will go away. And I think we have to have a very clear measure of victory that's attainable in the short term. War should not be long term. War should be quick, definitive, and over with. And certainly in the Middle East, we can achieve that. You know, after all, remember the Israelis won that six-day war. It took them 6 days. It shouldn't take the Americans more than five to win whatever war we decide. It's just we need to be resolved to win and to get out and to get rid of any, you know, restrictions on American freedom that come about because of a war.
All right. Now, just to change the subject, over on capitalism, for some reason, Obama seems to feel that if you make money, it's a bad thing. But our society is based upon the model of capitalism. It wouldn't work any other way. But he still then does the crony capitalism and thinks that's good. You know,
what are we going to be doing? But again, I mean, I think we live in a culture today. I mean, this is very sad, and this is why the country's moving in the wrong direction. Is we live in a country where people are suspicious of making money. And it's not just Obama. Unfortunately, it's a majority of Americans. So, for example, I'll give you an example. When Bill Gates made a lot of money, he made a lot of money by selling us all products we wanted. He didn't rip us off. He didn't lie, cheat, or steal. He made money by being a great businessman. We all resented him for it, and we were suspicious of him. And he wasn't considered a great person. When did Bill Gates become a great person? He became a great person when he decided to give it all away, to become a philanthropist. And that's tragic. So making money, creating wealth, creating jobs, creating money for creating value for all of his customers, touching every person on the globe because of what Microsoft managed to do to all of our technology, that we don't give any moral, ethical weighting. Giving his money away, that is virtuous. That is good. That makes him a good guy. That morality, that needs to be abandoned. That needs to be crushed across the entire political spectrum. Making money is good. Creating a business, building a business, building products, selling them to customers, that is good. That's all win-win. Those are trade relationships. That, to me, is the essence of morality. The essence of morality is people taking care of themselves by making money and by trading with other people so that those other people can take care of themselves. Everybody wins, and we still live in a culture, unfortunately, which views capitalism and the profit motive and making money suspiciously and resentfully. And you see that in Romney's inability to defend private equity. You know, this is his profession, and yet he can't actually articulate what it is that he did and why it's of value and why it's good and why it's moral. He almost apologizes for it. So I think across the political spectrum, and particularly Republicans who claim to be for freedom and for business and for capitalism, we need to get a moral backbone. We need to be willing and able to defend capitalism from a moral, ethical perspective and not let the left get away with it, not give the left the moral high ground.
Yeah, which brings me around to the CEO payouts. I see nothing wrong with them. If they honestly work for that money and they deserve those payouts, why hold them back and then, you know, oh, look at this company. They're paying the CEO so much more. But they worked hard for that.
Yeah. It's not your money. The people paying out the CEO salaries are the shareholders. If the shareholders don't like what the CEO is doing, they can fire him. The fact that they're paying him so much money suggests that he's creating value for them. And if they're being stupid and paying him more than he's worth, that's their problem. It's not my problem. So we live in a society of envy. We look at people's high salaries, like CEOs, and we resent it. We're envious of it, and that is horrible. These people make a lot of money because they produce huge amounts. They're incredibly productive. They create the products and the services that we all benefit from. They are giants of industry. Now, granted, some CEOs are cronyists. They get the money from government, but the solution is not to tax the CEOs. The solution is to get government out of the business of business. Government has no business running business, has no business choosing winners and losers, and has no business subsidizing business, giving them tax credits. I wish the Republicans would adopt this simple plaque and commit themselves when they got into power to doing one simple little thing. But if they did this, they would win every election. Stop all subsidies to business. All government favors to business, everything. Just level the playing field. Get out of choosing winners and losers. Get out of subsidizing it. Get rid of the import-export bank. Get rid of farm subsidies. Get rid of all the way that the governments tinker with the business world, and let's have a real market out there. Also, at the same time, get rid slowly of the regulations. You know, slowly, every year, 10% of the regulations get written off the books. Eliminate them. If you did that, our economy would boom. It would explode with innovation. It would explode with entrepreneurship. get the government out of business. And American people would go for this because, you know, people who claim to be Democrats, they hate the cronyism. Let's get rid of the cronyism by getting rid of government subsidies.
Amen to that. As a matter of fact, I was at the University of South Carolina. As a matter of fact, you're on your way to a speech? Or did
I
you just...
I just spoke at Charlotte Law School, and I'm on the way to Clemson. I'm going to speak at Clemson tomorrow, and then at the College of Charleston on Thursday.
Oh, excellent, because we had the Rock the Vote rally here at the University of South Carolina, the Bluffton campus, and I was the last Republican speaker. And when I said, you know, get rid of regulations, oh, my goodness, you would have thought I just murdered their family. And I had to explain to them. I said, you know, just there's a story going around. This one woman, I heard her calling on a local radio show. It may have been Sean Hannity. I'm not sure. And she had said that it takes her 10 hours a week just to fill out for the EPA all the forms if she were to move a single bag of fertilizer from one part of her barn to another part. 10
yep.
hours of paperwork just to move a bag of fertilizer.
I'm not surprised. I mean, a banker friend of mine told me, he's a CEO of a large bank, and he says of 5 working days, he spends 4.5 on regulatory issues. So he actually runs the bank half a day a week because the rest is just dealing with regulators. I mean, we have created a regulatory state that is a monster. It actually is worse than Europe. It's worse than Canada. It's worse than many Asian countries. We are killing our businesses with high corporate tax rates, massive amounts of regulations, but it's also the flip side. It's the subsidies. You know, get rid of the subsidies. Let us have real competition, real innovation. Yeah, I mean, I wish the Republicans would advocate for this. I think it's a winning issue, and it would get this economy. Imagine if they took those hours filling out paperwork and actually worked, produced stuff during those hours. I mean, we would thrive. GDP growth would be 5-6%.
I may have lost the good doctor.
I think one of the parts that really is frustrating. And let's just call it Business A. Business A has the federal government all over from the EPA endless. Then they have state regulations, then local regulations. Obviously, we need regulations in place for certain situations, whatever your business is. But, I mean, you're almost asking this person, don't start a company. I mean,
in California, you need a license from the government to shampoo hair. Right? I mean, government is everywhere in every aspect. And I'm not just talking about federal government. You're absolutely right. Federal government, local government. And look, I'm an advocate for no regulation. I believe that the laws we have on the books against fraud, against deceptive trade practices, against cheating, those laws are good enough to protect us from the bad guys. The rest the market can take care of. We do not need government inspectors to inspect our elevators so they don't fall. We don't need food inspectors. Nobody has an interest in poisoning their customers. We need the market to actually work. We need the market to be allowed to work. It'll create safer products for us. It'll create healthier products for us. It'll create better work environment than anything the government can give us. We need markets to actually be allowed to work. They never have been allowed to work. We've always had government interference, and it's over the last 100 years, it's just exploded.
Yeah, that it has. If you think about how much it costs, as you're talking about just production, but on the consumer end of it, how much we end up paying, because that bank is not going to have high interest rates for your savings or your investments, because now they have to take that money that they would normally pay out to you and put it into their own institute to pay to take care of these
regulations. At the end of the day, we as consumers and we as employees pay for it everywhere. Our standard of living today in America is unimaginably lower than what it would be if we had free markets in this country. I mean, that's the problem. We can't imagine how good life could be if we actually had free markets, the kind of technologies we have. I mean, think about the brain power today that goes into making an iPhone slightly better. Think that brain power was freed up to make banking better. You know, the automobiles we drive are basically the same automobiles we drove 50 years ago. Technology is not innovated when it comes to cars. It's the airplanes we fly are the same airplanes we flew in the 50s and 60s. The one innovation was the Concorde. You remember the Concorde? And they grounded that. The regulators grounded that. They wouldn't let us develop supersonic airplanes. Where the personalized plane is, the personalized helicopters. I mean, if you think of what is possible if you have real free markets, it's just unimaginable. And we are so pathetic in a lack of imagination and letting the government control and rule our lives and lower our standards of living and just destroy our capacity to grow and innovate and create. I mean, we lack imagination. This world could be so, so much better. The poor would be much richer than they are today. The rich would be much richer than they are today. We'd all be richer than we are today if only the government got out of the way.
That's so true. I mean, that is so perfectly put. You know, if you really honestly think about it in many, many ways, organized labor, it gets crushed by government. If they left it up to the owner and the rank and file to deal, government wasn't even involved, and the company thrived, everybody would do well. But the bottom line is,
absolutely,
the problem is when government puts their hand in everyone's pocket, down everyone's pants, and in the TSA's got it way down in your pants. But I mean, it's so true.
Yeah.
Just get the hell out of the way. Let the law of the land take care of the problems. I mean, I find it amazing that if Joe's Tool and Die Shop is having a strike, how the hell is that President Obama's business? That's between Joe and his rank and file. It's none of my business either.
Absolutely. And you know, the biggest victims are good workers. The biggest victims are ambitious poor people. The biggest victims of government are people who want to rise up in life. And the regulation, the entitlements, the redistribution of wealth, all of that destroys their capacity to rise up. It makes them, you know, it puts up barriers that they cannot overcome. It takes their whatever wealth they create away from them through taxes. It doesn't allow them to negotiate fairly with their employers. No, there's no question about this. This is a system set out to destroy the productive, the honest, the rational, the moral person, and it supports the leeches and the parasites and the worst people in our society. They're the ones who get rewarded.
Yeah, now, you know, I'm finding something that's very enlightening, that I read an article recently that France is trying to up the number of women that must serve on corporate boards. I think at this point it's like 10% going up to 20%. I forget what the numbers exactly are. But that's equal opportunity – not equal opportunity. That's I'm just going out of my mind. Thank you. Affirmative action, which – something that drives me nuts. If you're qualified for a job, it shouldn't matter who you are, what your gender is, your skin tone. It shouldn't matter. If you're qualified for the job, then you should get the job. And that is the one thing that drives me absolutely insane.
No, you're absolutely right. Look, this country has a very horrific history of racism. But you don't overcome racism by being a racist. You don't overcome racism by practicing racism. And affirmative action is racist. It is any attitude that views people qua their race, that either gives them favors or discriminates against them or for them, is a racist policy. It's affirmative action is racist, and it should be abolished. The only way to achieve, a colorblind society, in the words of Martin Luther King, is to be colorblind, you know, is not to view people based on their race, but to view people based on their ability, exactly what you said. So I agree with you. It drives me nuts when people do this.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was on the opposite end of that, where I was told, I'm sorry, you're white, can't hire you. And they don't realize.
What he said has such valid. I used to have a supervisor. He was the owner of a company. He had nightclubs, very, very successful. At the age of 23 or 24, he became a college professor, took his money and invested in these nightclubs. And I asked him, I said, how did you ever get involved being an entrepreneur? And he was extremely successful for the things he did, all the while he was still a college professor. He said, well, I was a Detroit police officer. And when I when the mayor was elected, I knew at the age of 22 my chances of getting promoted were almost zero due to affirmative action. You don't really find, in a lot of ways, he's a smaller Bill Gates on a much smaller financial scale. But at the age of 22, he understood this exactly as you're putting it and thought, I don't have a chance. So he went, obviously, in a different direction in his life. It just makes so much more sense. I mean, if you really stop to think about, look at all the money this election is costing, whether individuals are donating, whether corporate donations, whether the union donations, if we were to take all that money, how much more money would we have for just investment in this country as a capital country if we got rid of this damn regulation and on top of the BS that we go back and forth arguing over? I mean, does it really matter what a label says? You're going to know what it says, or whatever the issue may be as far as the regulation. And I strongly agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more when you said, you know, let the market take over.
Yes, no, I mean, the amount of wealth that would be created, again, is unimaginable. If you think about the amount of money that the government sucks out of the private economy and wastes every single year, the trillions, not billions anymore, it's trillions, you know, if that was properly invested in productive activity, wow. I mean, it's hard to imagine.
What motivated you, like, when did you have the idea for writing this book?
Well, I've been talking about capitalism and about the virtues of capitalism for over 10 years now. Been lecturing all over the country, teaching classes and courses on it. And about four years ago, you know, was thinking that I really need to put this in writing because, you know, just talking about it, it's somewhat ephemeral. You know, you speak and it's gone. You want to be able to leave your audiences with something they can take home, they can read, they can really ponder, they can really think about, and really absorb, and that's how you really change people's attitudes. So, you know, I approached Don Watkins, who works for me, and we decided to collaborate and write this book together, and, you know, it's been terrific. And then, of course, the Obama got elected, and the Tea Parties happened, and that provided more inspiration, because we felt like what the Tea Parties need is intellectual ammunition. What they need are the ideas. They have the right emotion. They have the right view. But what they need is a much better foundation, ideological foundation. And I think the book is really for the Tea Parties. This is a book for you. It's about what free markets really mean. What are the arguments that are going to win us the day? What is the kind of moral, ethical stand we need to take in order to preserve or reestablish capitalism in this country and how it will work? So. You know, it's about a free market revolution. How do we go from where we are today to having real free markets in America?
And where can people pick up your book?
Really, anyway, you know, it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I've been noticing it as I fly around the country. It's in airport bookstores, so you can go into the airport bookstore and ask for it. It's called Free Market Revolution. It's an easy name to remember. And it's on Kindle. You can get audio versions of it. So, you know, in any format, really, you can enjoy the book.
I'm looking at this email. We have this email. This lady at our library, she knows I'm big into the library locally, and she listens to our show every now and then. I've already gotten an email. She says, just so you know, I've already ordered the book for you, Mike. Thanks. I was like, well, because libraries are great sources. I can't afford to buy a lot of books, and I like the audio version. Annie likes the hard copies, and she likes to sit and read with a good book in the evening. I like the audio copies. I like to hear the voices almost as if I'm sitting before them and they're coaching me or they're next to me at a table. And, you know, I mean, that's great. And I think that's terrific. She said, yes, I got the audio version for you. So she's listening live.
Excellent. Good for Annie. And, yes, that's wonderful. And, you know, hopefully other local libraries have the books too, but certainly all the bookstores have it now. And, you know, the paperback will be out sometime next year, so it'll be cheaper. But, you know, I think it's a good read. The reviews, you know, people who've just read it, you know, saying that it reads easily. So I think people will enjoy it if they pick it up.
A quick question before we throw it back to Annie. how the hell did we get into this mess industrial-wise? I mean, it's basically big business versus union government versus how did we get so divided and so we're all spinning?
We got into this mess slowly, little bit by little bit. Nobody ever objected to the little bit. The government grew a little bit. It was just to solve this one little problem, and nobody stood on principle and said, that's not the role of government. Government shouldn't be doing that. It feels good right now, but there are always unintended consequences, and it's a slippery slope. Once the government helps these people, what about those people over there? And it's a little bit. It's like, you know, we started out with Social Security as a very small program just to help, you know, when life expectancy was below 65, those people who made it to 65 and were having a hard time. And now everybody makes it to 65, and you know, we haven't changed the retirement age. And the program has grown, and now it's indexed to inflation, and now it's become a huge entitlement program where we're redistributing wealth from young people to old people in the biggest redistribution of wealth in human history. And it's a huge injustice. So, you know, regulations are the same way. You know, oh, that factory, they had a problem, so they must represent the whole industry, so we need to regulate all the industry. But it's just this one industry. You promise we won't regulate anybody else. And then, of course, they do, and they do it increment by increment. And this has been going on since 1890. So it's been going on for 130 years. Slowly, 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 government is taking over our lives, and we're suffering the consequences of it. And at some point, it tips, and it's too late. And I think we're fast approaching that point.
You specifically mentioned a year. So did it basically start with the, you know, J.P. Morgan and Carnegie type, the strike and, you know, the kind of the turn of the century, huge industrial.
No, those are all good guys. I think that, you know, if we ever get real historians in this country, we will remember Carnegie and Mellon and J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller as the heroes of America, as the people who built this country, who created, you know, the mightiest industrial, you know, country in human history. And you know, created this fantastic country and the innovation, and those businessmen were terrific. Now, the 1890 is when Congress passed the antitrust laws, and that's the beginning of the end, because antitrust laws are some of the worst laws on the books. They are direct intervention in the economy. They are a way to penalize success, to penalize the best among us for the sake of those who can't compete.
That's the truth.
What you're saying is when Company A has a monopoly and person B and C and D see how successful and how much profit they're making, then they get motivated to basically start kicking ass, correct?
Absolutely. I don't believe that in a free market there is such a thing as a monopoly because that reason. There's always competition. There's always some young entrepreneur who's going to beat you if you turn your head for 1 second away from the ball. So there's no example of history in a free market of a real monopoly because of that, because there's always those competitive juices are running. Somebody will compete with you. Somebody will drive you out of business if you don't perform to the best of your ability. So monopolies are created by government. You know, the post office is a monopoly, and you know how good that functions. Our utility companies are monopolies because the government controls them and regulates them. We're turning our banks into monopolies because the government is regulating them and controlling them. So government is the one who grants monopoly power. You leave the free market alone, there are no monopolies.
Oh, I hope that happens. Well, Doctor, it has been a pleasure having you aboard, and I would welcome you back anytime.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I enjoyed it.
Wow, we really enjoyed you, too, and I'm looking forward to reading your book. Also, I'm going to, if you can get me your email address, maybe I'll purchase a hard copy and have you autograph it for Annie for Christmas or something along those lines.
I would be happy to. We'd be happy to. It's a whitebrook@einrand.org.
Wow.
Thank you so much, Doctor. You drive safely now.
Thank you.
Yeah,
bye,
we'll obey those speed limits. Not... Wow, that is a true crash course right there in free market economy, period. bar none, period. Obviously, you do have to have some laws in effect, but, I mean, that's very true. When you stop when you really lower the regulation threshold, picture the Olympics and track and field. Probably the biggest event is is when they have the team, you pass the baton, that race at the end of the Olympics, the fastest of the fastest. Picture if they had to weave in and out of traffic or dodge things in that race. That's exactly what you're doing when you create these barriers. You prevent the speed, the fast, the quickest from really being the speed, the fast, and the quickest. So maybe
it just explains why Obama's economic policies are not working. And if you're in the state of New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, Wisconsin, Iowa, Colorado, and Nevada, get out there and vote. We have to fire Obama. Today's election day, so please get out there and vote. You know, Mike, this whole afternoon has gone so fast. I want to let the listeners know that on Friday, we're going to have our Hollywood producer, Bettina Viviano, come back on. So I hope everyone joins us on Friday, same bat time, same bat station. And I want to remind you also, right after this, go over to Conservative Nation Radio. Billy and Brenda, the Women's Patriot, have their show following this. And after that, we have Stefan Vandergast, TPZ. He's from 6 to 8. From 8 to 9, we've got Dr. C. Robert Jones, the Situation Report. And from 9 to 11, we have Dana Smearman and G-Ski on the Conservative Watch Hour. And the evening finishes up from 11 to 1 with Jermaine, who's GGT183, with Cool Mike in the Conservative Primetime. So see you back here again.
I don't like Stephen Vandergast. I want his voice. Every time I listen to his show, I get jealous because it's just so perfect. He could do commercials and stuff and just he did not even leave his house and make a fortune. I want that. Maybe President Obama limit him from talking, and then I can use his voiceover with the new regulations. But Annie, let's the next time we meet, let's hope that an awful lot of things change. And hey, you know, we'll talk about it on Friday, and let's really hope for a true, true defender of the Declaration victory all throughout the next 24 hours.
Yes. So until Friday, same bat time, same bat station. We'll see you then. And if I can, I'm going to drop into the other shows. But I do have a election party to go to at 7 o'clock, so I'll be just on my cell phone. So until then, be safe and God bless, and may God bless these United States today.
Good night, everybody.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.web.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
Americans.